obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Good evening. My name is Marty. I'm alcoholic. And I'm fortunate to be sober today. It's a great day to be sober. I want to welcome the people that are early in sobriety, and I want to thank the committee for asking my wife and I to come down to for the weekend. It's a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA. I am I'm sober since September 25th of 2002, and through great sponsorship, commitment, and relationship with God, I have a wonderful life today. To tell you a little bit about me, I was born in northern New Jersey. Are we hearing everything all right? Is this, am I too close to the mic? We're good? Okay. I was born in northern New Jersey. I'm one of five children. My mother raised the five of us by herself. My mother and father divorced when I was a couple of years old. It was early or mid-1960s. I mostly was raised in my grandmother's house. We lived upstairs on the second floor. I had a wonderful childhood. I didn't know anything was wrong. I think other people knew something was wrong, but I didn't know anything was wrong. When I was about, I guess I was about 7 years old, some defects of character started coming out. I'm not an early drinker. I wasn't a drinker when I was 10 or 12, like other stories I've heard. When I was about 7 or 8 years old, I started doing something, a defect that followed me through most of my life. And I walked to school in the morning with my brothers and my sister, and on the way home from school, I stopped at a gas station. The guy who owned the station's name was John Ryan, and I asked him if I could use his bathroom. And he said, yes, you can. And when I walked in, I saw a Dixie cup full of dimes. And I looked outside, and he was pumping someone's gas, and I put my hand in, and I took two dimes out, and I put them in my pocket. And for the next couple of years, I asked John Ryan to use his bathroom almost every day. And I didn't know it was an issue. I wanted baseball cards. That's what I wanted. And I would take those dimes and I would buy baseball cards with them. And like I said, I had a wonderful childhood. We played in a big backyard, and I lived in somewhat of a nice area in New Jersey. And it was a mixed group of people. And I loved playing sports. The park was right down the street. We would leave the house in the morning during the summer. We'd go down to the park, and I'd make pot holders for my mother, and we would play wiffle ball, and we would just have a good time, and we'd come back at, as it was. I can remember being there all day long and then just coming home when it was time, and it was beautiful. When I was about 11 years old, like I said, I'm one of five children, and my mother took me to a counselor, and I didn't really think much about it, and I sat down with this counselor, and the only thing that I can really stand here and remember about that conversation with that counselor is I didn't tell him the truth. He would ask me questions, and I would either avoid them or I'd tell him some kind of story. And many years later, I asked my mother why she ever sent me there. And she said, you were 11 years old, and you were really having a hard time telling the truth. You would make up these stories. And she said it was pretty common that young children make up stories to fit in. She said, but your lies were... they had detail. You know, and she said, detailed lies are scary. You know, and I think I was about 12 years old, and my oldest brother, Joseph, he was 4 years older than me, And he was making a couple dollars working somewhere, and I remember this like it was yesterday. Mod Squad was on. That's what I remember. And I walked into the back room, and we all pretty much, this was a really big double bedroom that had this sliding door, and it was four boys and a girl, and my sister was toward the back, and my brother Joseph had this dresser that was my grandmother's old oak dresser, and I remember opening the drawer and taking $2 of my brother's money. And let me tell you, all hell broke loose. It wasn't 10 cents out of John Ryan's Dixie cup anymore. It was $2 from my brother Joseph. And my mother, when things were really, really tough, she would call my father. And my father was in the pizzeria business, and he came down and asked, what's going on over here? Who took $2 from Joseph? And they had narrowed it down to me and my brother John. And, of course, I denied it to the very end. And in making amends to my brother John 30-some-odd years ago, he said, you know the thing that really pissed me off? And I said, what? Because there was a long list by then of 30 years of taking advantage of my brother John. He said, do you remember when you stole that $2 from Joseph? And he said, oh, that bothered me forever. It said, you know what, today it still bothers me that you didn't fess up and that they thought it was me. And the problem with my mind was I somewhere in my mind, sorry means you should forget about it. Anything I've done, if I say sorry, you should dismiss it as, well, he said he's sorry, and let's forget about it for the rest of our lives. And I don't know why my brain works that way, but it does. I know one thing's for sure is that there's a line in the book that says that alcohol is just a symptom of the disease. And I have a gentleman named Billy Smith who I really care about, and he would pulled me to the side one time, and he said, alcohol's a symptom, but don't forget that it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And that what got me here was alcohol. And what happened to me over the course of years is I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that my symptoms, this way that I think, this selfishness, this self-centeredness, this consideration of other people's feelings were the core problems in my life, this soul sickness that I had no idea that I had. When I was 15 years old, I picked up my first drink. I was on the train tracks with my brother's friends. They were a couple of years older than me, and they were good guys to hang around with. Their nicknames were Slob and Crut and, Moose. And they had a bottle of white cream Concord wine, and they were passing it around. And I think I had a glass of beer one time. But alcohol was not a problem. And then one day, this white cream Concord came around, and I wanted to fit in. So they passed it to me. And the only thing that I really remember about that day was one of the guys said, okay, come on. You're taking too much. And I was one of those guys, and to this day, I still drink everything very fast. You give me a bottle of water, I drink almost a whole bottle. A can of soda, 11 of the 12 ounces is down before I even know. And that's how I drank wine, that's how I drank alcohol. I drink for the effect. Even today, without looking for an effect that produces some kind of thought process, I think I'm thirstier than I am. And I don't know about that, but some people identify with that. I'm a big drinker. And I was 15 years old, and my mother's a huge part of my story. Like I said, my mother raised five of us by herself, and about 15 or 16 years old, I started understanding how much I didn't like my father for not taking care of my mother, for not paying child support, for not showing up in my life, and not being at my baseball games. And I never noticed it before I was 15 or 16, but I became a guy who started noticing. And it wasn't just noticing my father. I started, and unbeknownst to me at that point, I started noticing the world. I'm one of those guys that was complaining about stuff that had absolutely nothing to do with me. And to this day, I still, 11 years sober, I'm still complaining about stuff that has nothing to do with me. You know, I'm complaining about an opinion that I'm not even supposed to have. And so I'm 15 years old, and I get drunk that night, and I don't want to disappoint my mother. I don't want my mother to see me drunk, so I come in the back part of the house, and I think if I can get to the bedroom, maybe I can get away with this. And I get sick, and I'm in the bathroom, and my mother comes in, and she finds out that I'm drunk, and I don't think she's so shocked, but she's, you know, I'm afraid that she's going to call my father. And I remember saying, as I'm throwing up, you know, I hear some people say that they had that first drink, and it was this euphoria of, oh, I've just found what I've been missing my whole life. That's not my story. My story is I drank so much so fast that I got so sick that I was quitting from the first day. As I was throwing up that night, I am never going to do this again. If you please, God, if you make me stop throwing up, I will never do this again. And so I'm a quitter from the first day. You know, I'm not this bad. I can tell you something. I know a lot of people that drank cocktails and fine wine. I'm not that guy. I'm a low bottom drunk. I drink wine with no grapes in it. I have, you know, I'll drink anything. It doesn't matter. So I remember I'm never going to drink again after that first time. I'm an athlete. I'm 15 years old. You would never see that now, but at 15 years old, I was an athlete. I loved sports, and I loved playing, and drinking wasn't, you know. Some guys were smoking weed in high school, and I didn't like that, and alcohol. I got sick that first night, and I said, I'm never going to drink again, and about a week later, they were on the train tracks again, and they had a bottle of Wild Turkey, and I said, maybe Wild Turkey's different. And I drank too much, too fast, and the next thing I know, I'm getting sick again, and I'll never do this again. And I can tell you something. I've been coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous since I'm like 19 or 20 years old, okay? And from 19 to 35, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I raised my hand. I'm an alcoholic, and I wasn't an alcoholic. Deep down inside, I wasn't an alcoholic, but it sounded good. I'm in AA, and I'll announce myself as an alcoholic, but I'm not really alcoholic. I'm too young, and I don't have enough drinking history. And if you'd ask the people who loved me, the people who were close to me, there's something wrong with Marty, but alcoholism, probably not. I got my first big book when I was 20 years old, and I read the first pages in my big book when I was 40. And I know I'm not the only person who's done that. I'm 18 years old, and I start drinking a little bit. I'm working at this mob restaurant in New Jersey, and it's the late 70s, and guys are walking around, and they got pockets full of money. This is before credit cards and debit cards and all that, and it's northern New Jersey. And there's all these big shots, or I think they're big shots. Buy him a drink, give him a drink, give them a drink, give them a drink. And I'm like, oh, man, that's what I want to be. I want to be a guy with a pocket full of money that you need a rubber band to hold the money together. I want to buy everybody a drink. I want to be somebody that they say, oh, yeah, that guy. And so I start working as a busboy, and I got my first car, 17 years old. I bought a 1973 Vega for $150. It was hand painted. And And it was, somebody told me that there was this club up in, right by New York City. It was called Elegante. And I had never been to a club before. And I went there. I drove the Vega up there by myself. And I parked, and there was a line to get in this place. And I remember getting in line, and I said to the person, "Why is this place so busy?" And they said, "The Manhattans are here tonight." And I was like, "Great." It was $15 to get in. And I was like, "Wow, 15 bucks to get in." But the Manhattans are playing tonight. So I went in, and back then, vodka and tonic was my drink. And I started drinking these vodka and tonics with squeezes of lime in it. And you know, I'm one of those guys, I drink too fast, and I'm putting them down. And back then, they gave you a drink. They were big, tall glasses. And I'm drinking these things. They were like $3 a piece. And I got money in my pocket. It's small, but I got a rubber band around it. And I'm trying to be this big shot. I'm buy them a drink, give him a drink, you know, give them a drink. And I'm this fake Guido from Northern New Jersey. Give everybody. And the Manhattans go on. And they're singing Kiss and Say Goodbye. And I'm drinking this vodka and tonic. And like in Bill's story, it says, "I have arrived." I had felt something I had never felt before. I felt like I had arrived. Like, wow, this is really fun. This is a lot of fun. And I started going up to this place a couple times a week and then three times a week. And I worked for this guy. His name was Frank Bucco. His name is Frank Bucco. And I started working for him when I was about 16. And he was the closest thing I'd ever had to a father. He took me under his wing. He started showing me things about the restaurant business. And he said something to me one night, and he said, "You know, you have a lot of potential." And I remember, I went home, and I remember saying, "Me?" No one had ever said that about me. And I started going to work with a, I wanted to impress him. I wanted to be a guy that he looked at and said, I wanted to be, to tell you the truth, I wanted to be his son. And I started working, and he really took care of me. And then when I started going to that club, he pulled me to the side one night. He said, "I know you're up to something." He said, "You better straighten your act out." And I said, "What? I'm not doing nothing." He said, "I know you're doing something. Just watch yourself." And I went up to this place, and I was drinking, and I had to use the restroom. And I went into the restroom, and it was a restroom that didn't have a door on the inside of the place. And I see this guy, and he pulls out this little vial. I mean, it was the littlest thing you ever saw in your life. And it had this little spoon on it. And it was 1981. And I saw him go like this. And when he came back, his eyes were wide open. I said, "What is that?" He said, "It's cocaine." And I found out that night that if you use cocaine, you can drink a lot. And I mean a lot. And I started drinking a lot. And a little bit like Bob's story, where it talks about mixing sedatives and alcohol, I started forming this mix that would allow me to drink and work and not get hungover. And I started going to work, and but things started changing. I was a guy whose nails were always clipped. His shirt was always ironed. I was a guy who showed up early and stayed late. And I became a guy whose shirt was wrinkled. His nails were dirty. His shoes were unshined. He was a guy who came in late and wanted to leave early. And Frank Bucco called me over and he said, I'm telling you, if you don't get your act together, I'm going to have to fire you. And about 2 weeks later, I was off on a Thursday night. And I stayed out really late. And I said, I better get some sleep before I go to work. No cell phones at that time. And I fell asleep and I woke up. And I had to be at work at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I woke up, it was 9 o'clock at night. And I called the restaurant. Frank got on the phone. He said, you get over here and you come through the kitchen. And he fired me. And I was lost. I didn't even know it, but I look back at it today, and I was lost. I didn't even know how much that job meant to me, how much he meant to me, how much I was walking in the wrong direction. I had no idea. And within 3 years, I was sitting in prison for the first time. And 1984, I'm sitting in prison. I get out in 1986, and everything's going to be different. And I'm on this intense supervision parole, and I get through the parole. And as soon as the parole is over, I start drinking again. And within a year, I'm back in prison again. And it looks like I'm a prison story, because I'm not getting DUIs. I'm not getting so drunk that I'm creating problems in the community. I'm a thief. I'm a thief since I'm 7 years old. I'm a kid who can't tell the truth since he's 11 years old. I've got all these defects that have never been looked at, talked about, inventory, never talked to another man about. I have no idea what that's all about. The only thing I know is that I did it again. And I'm writing these letters to my mother and to my sister while I'm in prison. I promise you, I'm reading the Bible, and you know, I'm going to all these classes, and when I get out, it'll be different this time. And could you please send $20 for my account? And at the beginning, my mother's coming to see me, and my sister's coming to see me, and my brother's sending money. And by the fifth time I'm in prison, there's nobody coming to see me. I spend from 1984 till 2002, I spend 12 and a half years locked up. And during that time, I have a baby girl. My daughter Miranda is 21. She was born March 26th of 1992. I'm living in Philadelphia because I'm hiding from the police. And my daughter's born. She's 7 pounds and 3 ounces. And I caught my daughter coming out. If you put 7 pounds and 3 ounces in my hand, I know what that feels like. It's the greatest moment of my life. And I promise and I know that I'm never going to drink and I'm never going to live like this anymore. I have a daughter now. I have a new life ahead of me. I'm going to take care of this child. And 2 weeks later, I'm selling her formula to get another drink. And like I said, I'm a low-bottom drunk. I'm a guy who winds up living either in prison or in the street, one or the other. Everybody else, in my brothers, my sister, all seem to have it together. And I just can't get it together. I'm the black sheep of the family. I put the label on myself. I can't go over by my family's house because I've stolen from everybody in my family. My mother, my grandmother. I never pay anybody back. I'm a guy who has this noise going on in his head that won't stop. I got out of here in 2001, the end of 2001. I had just come out of prison again. My mother was raising my daughter, and she said, I'll give you one more chance to be a father to your daughter. And I came out here, and I was sober about 4 days. And I started going to AA meetings out here, and I said, well, I'm sober about 4 years now. I just bought a house in Summerlin, and my car's being transported, and I hadn't had a driver's license in 20 years. I've been living, you know, I cannot tell you guys the truth because my life, I sponsor a guy and asked him, if you would describe your life in one word. He was very early in sobriety. I said, how would you describe it? And he said, pathetic. And I said, man, I know that. I know what it feels like to not be able to sleep at night because of all the things that I've done and all the things I want to do and all the things I know I can't do. The book talks about half measures avail us nothing. How about if you're a 25% kind of guy like me? I mean, if I started cleaning this room, you would absolutely know where I started and where it got bad. Because I would get to about that second curtain, and you would say, God, who's cleaning the rest of this place? They must have stopped there. Because that's the kind of guy I am. I'm a good starter, but I'm the horrible finisher. I got out here, and I went out to lunch with my brother John. And my brother John had moved here earlier, and he looked across the table at me, and he had that disgust look on his face. And he said to me, what is wrong with you? And I said, you don't understand. Every day, every night, I hear this noise in my head telling me what a horrible father I am, what a terrible son you are, how you're going to do it again. And he looked at me scared and said, you hear voices? And the voice in my head said, tell him no. So I told him no because I can't do anything that my head doesn't tell me to do. I have no mental defense. I'm powerless and I don't even know it. I think I have a problem. And I've been going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say that like I've ever done anything in AA in those years. I had never done anything in AA. I never even read the literature. I had never had a sponsor. People would say, who's your sponsor? Oh, you don't know him. He lives on the other side of town. And I wind up in West Care Detox the beginning of September of 2002. And how I wind up in detox, I had been living with my mother when I first moved here. And my mother's husband never liked me. I'm a 17-time convicted felon, and he's a retired DEA agent. And I know he doesn't like me. And he's got that look on his face, too. And he doesn't like me so much, he allows me to stay in his house. He dislikes me so much, he takes care of my daughter. And he pays her dental bills and her and puts food on the table and brings her back and forth to school. That's how much he doesn't like me. And I pay him back by stealing his coin collection that he's been saving for 40 years, one coin at a time, that he's been overpaying coins on the telephone. He's that kind of guy. And I'm stealing his coin piece by piece so that I can drink and lie and steal. And he loves my mother so much, he knows I'm stealing it and he doesn't say anything. What kind of man would do that? You're stealing from me and you're not going to say anything?
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And one night I stole his gun. And I wind up back in the streets again. I remember coming to my mother's house and her banging her hands on my chest, saying, you have to leave here. and my daughter in the other room. And here I am back on the streets. Now I'm in Las Vegas. It's just a new city with a new name, and I'm back in the same position. I'm going to wind up back in prison. Because back in prison, I don't have to worry about any of this stuff. I don't have to worry about responsibilities or getting it right or figuring it out anymore. Somehow I wind up in West Care Detox. And four men, Bob Darrell, George Boyer, Sheldon Fetty, and Craig Clove, were of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they brought a meeting into the West Care Detox. And I could hardly keep my head up. And these guys were talking, and they were talking too long, and they were glazing me over. I was, oh, whatever. And George Boyer said something. And it's weird because if you listen to George, George tells this long story. I mean, if he's, the story starts here, it goes all the way around the room. And by the time it gets to the water, you figured out what he was talking about. And for whatever reason, he said something that I heard. And I know everybody in this room has a person. If you've been sober and you think back of when you were early in sobriety, there was someone. One day, who said something that started a psychic change, and I didn't even know it. I grabbed George's phone number, and I he said, call me and I'll pick you up. And I didn't call him, and in a day I was drinking again. I wind up in a men's sober living house, and I was there for about a week, and a guy came by and asked if anybody was looking for some work, and I figured that's what I got to do. I got to get my act together. I get a job, you know, figure it out, start paying some bills, pay some people back. It'll be all right. Just put it together. You can do it. Come on. Come on. This is, you know, just, you know, you can do stuff. You're not stupid. You know the difference between right and wrong. And a guy paid me $60, and I never even made it back to the sober living house. And I wind up sleeping in the bottom of an empty swimming pool. 3 days later, it was about 8 o'clock at night, and I said, you know what, I'll go knock on the church's doors. Maybe somebody will give me $5, and I'm just looking to have a drink or try to get through the night. And I started walking across town, and I knocked on the church's door, and this deacon answered the door, and I wanted to ask him for $5. And I said, could I use your phone? And he let me use the phone, and I called the sober house that I was living in prior. And the funniest thing was the guy who owned the sober living house, he used to shut his phone off at 9 o'clock because he was studying to be a nurse. And it was about 9:30, and I tried calling him, and he answered the phone. And I said, Rich, can I come back to the house? I know, you know. And he said, if you can get here, you can sleep on the couch. I went to the corner of D Street in Washington, which is not the best neighborhood in Las Vegas. And I'm standing on the corner with no money in my pocket, and the bus comes by, and I stink because I've been out for days. And the door opens, and I ask the guy, can I get on the bus? I just need a ride to Jones. And he said, no. And I said, please. And he said, get in the back. And I didn't know that was my walk to sobriety. If you had told me that I would be sober since that day, there was no possible way. Because if I drank on September 24th, I always drank on September 25th. And if I drank on the 25th, I drank on the 26th. My MO is you have to lock me up or take me out, or I have to be passed out, sick, tired, something, for me not to drink once it gets started. And I don't know anything. I've been going to meetings for a long time. I have no idea what alcoholism is. I've never read the literature. I have never connected my story with the literature so that I can understand I'm alcoholic. I'm listening to other people, and their alcohol story is different than mine, and for some reason I can't put the two together. I think I'm a thief, dishonest, alcohol. I drink too much alcohol, I use too many drugs, I gamble, I'm in trouble. I lie, I cheat, I cheat, but alcoholic. And that day, I wind up on Richie's couch, and the following day, I called George Boyer, and he took me for a ride. And he really tricked me. I had no idea what he was talking about. I mean, there's a line in the book that says, in the doctor's opinion, unless a psychic change occurs, there's very little hope for the alcoholic. Now, if you were an alcoholic and your life was a mess, and somebody said, unless a psychic change occurred, there's very little hope, anyone with a half a brain would say, how do you get a psychic change? Not me. I don't ask those questions because I don't want you to think I'm stupid. So I figure I'll just figure it out as I go along. I'll go to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, listen and identify and shake my head and I understand. But never really put the literature together. So George takes me for this ride. He says, tell me a little bit about your life. And I said, man, I can't stop. I always do it again. I get brief moments where, you know, of recovery followed by still more relapse. But I'm not talking like that. I'm talking about, you know, I'm good for a little while and then, you know, all of a sudden hell breaks loose or you know, I don't have any money or I do something and something's crazy. And he said, wow, you sound so powerless. So he said, tell me about your life. I said, my life sucks. I can't show up for my daughter. I've stolen from everybody in my family. I got no place to go. I got no ID. I'm a 17-time convicted felon. I'll never get a job. I can't even get I can't get a health card. He said, your life sounds so unmanageable. And I don't know that this man is saving my life. He's putting the words into my vocabulary that I must have to become a person who understands what alcoholism is. He starts reading parts of the book, and it says, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Or once you start, you really don't have much control of the amount you drink. He starts going through the stories of the jaywalker. Sounds like, I did it again. And he starts saying things like, he starts putting things together, and I'm like, yeah, I understand that. And he's driving me around one day, and I remember he took his money out of his pocket, and he had $9. And he looked at his gas tank, and we went to a meeting. And after the meeting, he bought me a hamburger with the $9 he had in his pocket. And what he showed me was that he cared about me. And I felt like I was in front of Frank Bucco again. And I didn't want to lose him. So I started getting in the car with him. He said, I'll be here to pick you up every day. I'll introduce you to men who will pick you up and take you to meetings and show you how to stay sober. And I'm in. And I start getting in the car, and I'm getting up in the morning. And he said to me, you're going to become self-supporting. You're going to start paying your mother. You're going to start doing these things. And I was like, whoa, this is a lot. And I'm living in a men's sober living house. I have no ID. I got no place to go. And I'm getting up 5:30 in the morning. I'm taking a shower. I'm praying. Because he asked me, pray in the morning. Ask God for some help. And I always believed in God. I just never had a relationship with God. I had never had a commitment to prayer. I'm a 25%er. You tell me to pray, I'll pray for 2 days out of the week. 2 days out of the month. You know? So I start praying every day. I get up in the morning, take a shower, pray. Thank you, God. Please take me, keep me sober. Help me with my day. Direct my thinking. I'd get up and I'd walk to the corner and I'd steal the guy's newspaper. And I'd go to the AA club. And I had these tokens from Catholic Charity that I could get on the bus. And I'd go to the AA club and I'd look through the paper, waiting before the meeting. And I'd look for a job. And I couldn't find a job, and I couldn't find a job. And I'd get up in the morning, I'd take a shower, I'd pray, thank you, God, direct me, steal the guy's newspaper, go to the meeting. And I'm doing this for like 2 weeks, and I can't find a job in this paper. And I don't know why, but I said it out loud. I said, man, I've been stealing this guy's paper for 2 weeks. You would think sooner or later he would stop getting it delivered. And the guy said to me at the AA club, I don't even know who it was, he said, it's pretty hard to find a job with a stolen classified. And I went, what? Next day I wake up in the morning and I take a shower and I pray, ask God to direct my thinking. Walk out the house and I go to grab the newspaper and it was like it was on fire and my head said, you'll never stay sober if you don't stop stealing. And I left it. Looking back now, I know it was the first time I trusted God. I left the paper. About a week later, I went to a mall. They had this job fair. And I got no ID. I got nothing. And I walk in there and I said, I'd like to get a job. And they said, well, can we see your ID? I don't have any ID. You can't fill out, can't do this unless you have an ID. And I look over and I see Macy's. I was like, Macy's. Maybe they'll hire somebody. It's Christmas time. It's like November at that time, October. And I went in there and they didn't ask for ID. They said, "Phil," I said, can I have a, can I fill out a thing for a job? And they said, you do it on the computer. And I'm like, oh, man, I don't even know how to turn the computer on. And now this voice is coming back. Because I'm still early in sobriety and I don't have any self-esteem. I don't have any self-worth. I don't know anything about what's wrong with me other than, you know, my life is... And I poke my head in and the computer's on. So I start filling out this application. And it says, references. So, I'm early in sobriety, and if you're early in sobriety, if I'm your sponsor, you can do this, but if someone else is your sponsor, you probably can't. I started using ex-NFL football players as my references. guys that most people don't know, Steve Barkowski and, you know, kickers, Jan Stenerud, you know, people that nobody really knows, and, you know, just to put names down because it's hard to get a job with no references. That's what my head is saying. So about 2 weeks later, I get a phone call for an interview. And I go there and they say, well, what kind of work do you want to do? I said, I'll sell lady shoes. And they said to me, have you ever sold shoes before? And I had sold my own, so I said, yeah, I've sold shoes before. So I get there, now I'm through two-thirds of the stages, and I get there to this last stage, and I'm 40 years old at this time. I'm 2 months sober. And I get into this room, and there's this big table, and there's all these young kids. They're all getting their first job. They're 17 years old, and they're full of energy. And Macy says, our word is outstanding. Tell us why you want to work here, and use the word outstanding. I'm like, holy shit. And it's a little kid from, my name is John, I'm from Pittsburgh. My family loves Macy's, it's an outstanding company, and I would love to work here, even if it's just for the holidays. And then they called on this girl, and the girl said, my name is Jessica, and I love, and I have my first credit card from, I'm 17, and I have a credit card from Macy's. And my head said, I'm 40, and I never had a credit card. They came to me and I said, I'm Marty and I'm a, and I almost said I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I really need this job. And I promise if you hire me, I'll show up. And a week later, this woman, Patricia Light, I'll never forget her name. They hired me. A 17-time convicted felon. A guy with no ID. They hired me. And I remember walking in that place and saying, thank you, God. Thank you, God. I promise you, God. Thank you. And God had a crazy sense of humor. They had just opened the fashion show mall. And my job the first day is to do credit applications. I have 1,100 counts of credit card fraud on my jacket. And I'm sitting there and you're giving me your social security number. And I remember the voice in my head saying, don't mess this up. Don't mess this up. This is your last chance. And I remember those first few days I'm working there and I'm walking in the place and I got a white shirt on and a jacket and that my mother had bought me again. And I'm waiting for them to go. We need to talk. We hired the wrong guy. It wasn't Marty Camrod. It sounded like that. But it was someone different. And I was so afraid, I went up to human resources and I said, I gotta tell you something. And the woman looked at me and she said, I know, go sell shoes. I said, you know? Go sell shoes. So I went and I was like, thank you, God. I can't believe I got this job. And about 2 weeks later, I realized they didn't build the mall right. And if they had done it the right way, my way, we'd be busier and I'd make more money. And I'm working with this guy and I'm telling him about this and he looks at me and he said, next time they build a $2 billion mall, they'll probably call you. About a week or so after I had gotten that job, I was in the car with George, and he pulled over behind the Steps Club in Las Vegas. And he said, we're going to do third step prayer. I said, oh, man, I'm not ready for that. He said, you're a late stage alcoholic, and if you don't do this, you're going to die of alcoholism. And he said, we'll go back there, and there's this alley. And my head said, I am not getting on my knees with a man in an alley. Some guy's going to see this, and I am not doing that. And he took a blue towel out of the trunk of his car and a big book out. He said, do you know the third step prayer? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, just you can read that prayer or you can say any prayer you want. And I opened the book and I said, God, I offer myself to thee. And George put his hand on my shoulder and he said, do you? Do you really? And for the first time in 20 some odd years, when the pressure was on, I told the truth. I said, I don't know how to. I don't know how to turn my will and life over to the care of God. I don't know how to change this. I know I'm going to do it again. And he said, I'll show you. And he started showing me how to write an inventory. And I started finding out some of the things I was afraid of. And I didn't even know I was mad at people. I thought, how could you be mad at people? You've been screwing people over your whole life. How could you be mad at anybody? And I had this thing about my father. And I had never even touched it. I found out that I was mad at my father for not showing up for my mother. And I did this inventory and did a fifth step with George. I started looking at my defects. And one day I wrote a letter to my father. My father had passed away. And I got on a plane and I went to my father's grave for the first time. My whole life I thought my father was 53 years old when he died. And I got in front of his tombstone, and he was 51. And my head said, what kind of son does he know how old his father was when he died? And my perception started changing. A couple years later, I'm in the car with my mother, and my mother said, the hardest thing I ever did was tell your father he couldn't come back. And I went, what? She said, yeah, he begged to come back. But he had come back three or four times. My father was alcoholic and a compulsive gambler. And we were living in my grandmother's house. And if my mother took my father back one more time, we were going to have to move out of my grandmother's house. And she was protecting us kids. And I didn't know my whole life. I didn't know my father wanted to come back. And then I understood what it felt like to want to be there for your daughter and not be able to show up. And my perception changed a little bit more. And today I stand here and I've forgiven my father and I think he's forgiven me. I was 8 months sober and I was at that place where, right behind where I did my third step prayer. And I looked across the room and I saw a woman. She was 4 months sober, I was 8 months sober. And everybody said, you guys better stay away from each other. She was separated. I was living in a sober living house. I was riding a stolen bike with a crooked wheel. I was a real find. But I knew the big book. I was one of those guys that every meeting I listened and I thought of whatever people were talking about, I would think about where in the book is that? Where in the book is that? Where in the book is that? And I became a guy who knew what page this stuff was on. I became a guy who was all in. And I was 8 months sober. I had this job. I had no way to get there, no way to get back. I was driving the bus and... She was 4 months sober. And I fell in love with her. 10 years later, she's my wife. We made it. The story that wasn't going to work. The two people that were supposed to stay away from each other, we made it. Not gracefully. But we made it. I had a guy say this to me one time. I'll say this and I'll be quiet. He said, when are you going to join AA? I was early in sobriety. I said, you're a member when you say you are. He said, I didn't ask you that. When are you going to join AA? And I said, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. He said, I didn't ask you that. I asked you, when are you going to join AA? He said, it's in the book. So I figured join's got to be in the front of the book. It's, you know, anything would tell you how to join at the beginning. So I start looking through the book of how do you join AA. And on page 164, jokesters, it says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you found. And join us. And it's the only way to join, I found out for me. It may be different for other people, but the only way I can join AA is to do those things. I can't trust God, not clean house and help others. I have to trust God, clean house and help others. And I'm not standing here saying that I do that all the time. I'm a guy who doesn't offer himself to God every morning. I wish I did. I wish I did this thing exactly the way the book tells me to, because when I do it that way, this thing works great for me. I'm an alcoholic, and the reason I'm alcoholic is because I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. It differentiates me from an average temperate drinker. I put alcohol in my body, and I'm allergic to it. And my story may be different than other people's story in here, but that part, if you're alcoholic, doesn't change. If you have an allergic reaction to alcohol, then you have alcoholism. And that's what I have. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. It's given me a life I deserve because God tells me I deserve it. I trust God. I stay close to Him. I try to perform His work well. And He has provided everything that I need. It's the third step promise, top of 63. I love my life. I'm done. I appreciate you coming. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marty. Thank you so much. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.